Biscuit.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Roger Silverstone. I'm director of media at LSE here at the school, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you all to another sellout performance of a series of lectures organized by my colleague to the right here, Philip Gould, called From Kennedy to Blair, The Changing Role of Political Professionals. And it's my great pleasure this afternoon to welcome the Right Honourable Peter Mandelson, MP, to talk on the subject, the making of new Labour. Peter Mandelson, as many of you will know, is a key figure, in the creation of New Labour. From his first appointment 18 years ago as Director, Campaigns and Communications Director of the Labour Party, he transformed what would seem to be, have seemed to have been an unelectable party, not only to a newly electable party, but to a re-electable party. And we've invited him to talk and to reflect on some of the most important and significant dimensions of his time in that role. Let me just briefly introduce Philip Gould to my right here, who is the strategic and polling advisor to the Labour Party and a visiting professor at Media at LSE. Philip.
I'll just move up.
Well, welcome again. This is the second of the series of lectures that I'm organising with help, of course, from the LSE and my own staff. And the first was Alistair Campbell. The next will be Stanley Greenberg, who is probably the world's leading political pollster to President Clinton, Nelson Mandela, and others. And he will be talking on the 11th of March. One of the purposes of this lecture series is to show the human face of politics, what people believe, what they value, the personal qualities that are needed to achieve political change. When I first met Peter Mandelson 17 years ago, the Labour Party was as close to death as it is possible to imagine a political party to be. Working in the Labour Party was like working in a wasteland. 1,000 reasons why we would never, ever win another election. But Labour did win again, and won 2 huge majorities. In fact, in turn, laying waste the Conservative Party, leaving them now near dead. This did not happen by accident. It happened because of the bringing together of values, policies, visions, and beliefs. But perhaps above all, because of extraordinary human qualities. Qualities of endurance, qualities of just never giving up, qualities of continuing to believe when all seemed hopeless. But perhaps above all, the quality of courage. And let me tell you this, in all of politics, no one has more courage than Peter Mandelson. He is the kind of guy that when the press are hounding you and your opponents are assailing you, and when all seems hopeless, says it's time to attack. And time and time and time and time again, he has done that. He never blinks, he never bends, he always keeps on the attack. Now, sometimes his courage has got him into trouble. His career has had its ups and its downs. But let me tell you this. When Peter tells you today about the story of New Labour, it was his courage, almost more than anything else, that built New Labour. And when Peter tells you New Labour's story, he tells his own story as well. He is my friend. He is my colleague of 17 years. And I it's a great privilege to introduce him to you today, Peter.
Well, Philip, thank you very much indeed for that introduction, which, if it were half true, would be very nice. I'm delighted to be here to reveal the fact that I do have a human face, which I think many people have doubted for some time. And Roger, I think to describe this as another sellout performance unwittingly confirms the suspicions of all my left-wing critics who long ago decided that the making of New Labour was the destruction of socialism, which was true only in a very limited, narrow respect, which I shall come back to in a moment. When Philip asked me to speak, and I asked him what he wanted me to cover, he suggested in an email that I should sort of talk about the history of socialism, my life story, where New Labour came from, what makes Tony Blair tick, and where we all go from here, all rounded up into one seamless presentation of 20 minutes length. Excuse me if I'm a little bit more selective in what I have to say to you, but if at the end of what I've had to say to you there is any gap in your knowledge or any area that you would like to receive further elucidation, I strongly commend to you a book that is very economically priced and available in all good price bookshops called The Blair Revolution Revisited, which was updated with a new introduction and republished by me last year. So that's the plug. I mean, I assume you do have a good bookshop, you know, in this school. Look, why New Labour? There is no mystery or no rocket science about why New Labour was necessary. Very simply, the country, after 18 years of conservative rule, deserved something different. The country deserved a credible opposition, a credible alternative to the Conservatives, capable of advancing and embedding social democratic values and a social democratic perspective in our society without destroying the economy in the process. Voters wanted a fresh start. They wanted a new sort of politics. I mean, who can blame them after how many years of Mrs. Thatcher since 1979, followed by how many years it was of John Major? People wanted an end to the divisions and the dogma of the Conservative years. They wanted an end to the sort of politics that said you can't have social justice, you can't have compassion in our society, you can't have policies pursued by a government that reflects those values and at the same time have a dynamic, efficient economy. That somehow these two things were in contradiction to one another. And the country wanted an end to that. But they didn't see an alternative in going back to the old Labour Party nostrums, the old idea that seemed to be wrapped up in and represented by the Labour Party of old, that you could have plenty of social justice and heaps of compassion in society, but running a half-efficient and half-decent economy, I'm afraid, was beyond us. There had to be a different way in which we could both combine social justice and economic competence and efficiency in our country. And that is what we set out to combine, to put together in a credible, modern, workable program of government and put to the electorate in 1997. And the reason why I cared so passionately about doing that and putting together that workable program that would attract the majority support of people in the country was because Labour winning is what I had not seen for most of my life. For most of my life, and I'm now getting on a bit, Labour had lost elections. Conservatives had won them. That was the main story of the last century. And the reason why I cared so much about a Labour government succeeding once it had been elected to office was because during my time, during my upbringing when Labour had won. It had then gone on to fail, mainly in the economic sphere, but in other respects too, setting back the hopes and the trust of those people who had put Labour into office. And the people who lose out when Labour doesn't win, the people who were set back when Labour in office does not succeed, are the people in this country who need the Labour Party and what we do as a government as a platform on which they can stand, as a platform on which they and their families and their young people have a chance to get on, to realise the potential that is within inside them, to grasp the opportunities that only active government, decent high quality public services, education of the very best sort that we can achieve in this country, a first-rate health service when people can get ill, housing to put a roof over your head, all the best start in life that people are entitled to expect in a half-decent, well-off society, which is what we aspire to have in our country. And if you want to know about these people who need the Labour Party so much, if you want to know and meet the people who need that platform on which to stand that only a Labour government can provide, then come to my constituency. Come to the northeast of England. Come to Durham. Come to Hartlepool, which I represent in Parliament, where poverty, where unemployment, where denial of opportunity are still the blight that so many people in my constituency experience, very, very many fewer people now than was the case before Labour was elected, but still too many people who need that platform that only a Labour government can provide. So when people say to me, as sometimes they do, you know, what's the point in voting Labour? I mean, aren't you all the same? I mean, what's the point of voting Labour when you've done so much to, you know, kill off socialism and a party which has no more socialist conviction in it? I mean, why should we bother? I say it's true. We may not be the same as we were as a party, and we may not still conform to the knee-jerk stereotypes and the resolutionary politics that the Labour Party practiced for so long. But the difference between Labour now and Labour then is that not only are we in office rather than in opposition, but we are sustaining a government in office that is able, in a united, stable way, to implement a programme of far-seeing change in this country with a party which, rather than breaking up in division, stands united behind it. And that is the difference between this Labour government and Labour governments of the 40s, the 60s and the 70s. And it's because of what Labour believes in, it is because of what Labour has at its core, values and a body of belief in which we remain anchored, that gives us that strength of purpose, that gives us that ability to sustain what by any comparison is a very successful team of ministers in government running this country's affairs. Now, what makes me, therefore, the New Labour monster that I am, this sort of obsessive, is that in comparison to what we have now, we experienced, and I went through my childhood, and when I was a teenager and a student and after, just a succession of disappointments. The very first thing I ever remember in politics was riding my tricycle between the polling station and the committee room in some general election somewhere in the mists of time, somewhere in the late 50s, dare I say it, or early 60s. I remember standing in 1964 in the October general election of that year in front of the suburban North London house of Harold and Mary Wilson, the day after we won and the day they set off in their car to number 10 Downing Street to begin 6 years of Labour government. By the end of that Labour government, by the end of the 1960s, I was at school defending a Labour government that was encountering very serious economic crisis, spending cuts, retrenchment from the investment on which we had embarked in our public services, all of which was going wrong, culminating in the end of that government in a falling out between the then ministers and the trade unions over the then government's attempts to introduce reforms of the trade union movement in that white paper in place of strife that Barbara Castle rather boldly introduced and then even less boldly had to retreat from as she pulled down the flag of trade union reform, which gave such an opening to Mrs. Thatcher later when she embarked on her idea of reforming the trade unions. End of the 1960s, where, believe it or not, I remember sitting in an audience at school where I was heckling a Labour foreign secretary over the then government support for American policies in Vietnam and Cambodia. That is not an... That is not... No. No. Okay, that's enough. And then in the 1970s, after I left university, I went to work in the economic department of the Trades Union Congress, watching as the trade unions in the then Labour government, in the 70s now, rather than the 60s, were tearing themselves apart, culminating in the winter of discontent that provided, put that platform, that platform in place for Mrs. Thatcher to come into office. And then in the early 1980s, I'd moved on from the TUC and I was a councillor in the South London borough of Lambeth under Red Ted Knight, where we campaigned under the slogan of no compromise with the electorate. in Lambeth, as I remember as a councillor, where the police were regarded as agents of capitalism, where criminals were victims of capitalism, where riots were popular uprisings against capitalism, and getting your dustbin emptied was a bloody miracle. Now, I hope I'm just in a sort of way building up a picture of what the Labour Party had become by the time I started work in 1985 at the age of 32, on my birthday, in fact, October the 21st, if any of you are interested, at the Labour Party headquarters of Walworth Road to start the journey of rebuilding Labour, creating new Labour and getting us into government. It's where, incidentally, I met Philip Gould, with whom I then worked very happily for the next decade and more. He supplying most of the ideas for us and me supplying the steel. It was quite a good combination. But the Labour Party that I entered into and the headquarters that I joined as the Campaigns and Communications Director was a Labour Party team that was desperately divided. A very unhappy ship where few people wanted change, where the preoccupation of most people was the protecting of their backs, and where the only thing that seemed to unite people in our Labour Party team was their distaste for me and dislike of everything I stood for and what we were setting about doing in modernising and professionalising the Labour Party machine. And we got underway, and I won't, I'd love to spend hours telling you, recounting every twist and turn of what happened, but unfortunately you don't have the time or the patience. I have lots of time on my hands, but I've got nothing else to do. But anyway, I will let you go, you know, within a reasonable space of time. But I remember the first major thing we did in this sort of attempt to revamp the Labour Party was to launch something which Neil Kinnock, our leader, our new brave modernising leader, I say brave because he was a modernising leader of the Labour Party when it was definitely unfashionable to be a moderniser in the 1980s. But he wanted us to launch a campaign to claw back some of those values that Thatcher had commandeered. He wanted us to launch his campaign, Labour's campaign for freedom and fairness. And his idea was that we would put up posters which would have adorned the words Labour's campaign for freedom and fairness. And Philip and I thought that it might be more catchy if we just put Labour putting people first. You know, it's a more sort of user-friendly way of describing Labour's campaign for freedom and fairness. And I remember we did these, and I won't go into too much detail, but I'll just tell this story. I remember we did these wonderful publicity campaigning materials, lovely leaflets, lovely posters, in lovely badge. It was a sort of black, silver and grey enamel badge. Can you imagine anything so ahead of the curve as a black, grey and silver enamel badge which said putting people first? And we took all this in slightly in advance of the launch of the campaign to show Neil Kinnock. I was very excited. I thought, well, you know, a bit worried about Philip taking too much of the credit, obviously. I'm rather keener to bask in the glory by myself. And Neil's face just fell, and he just looked absolutely appalled. And I sort of kept going, dug myself sort of deeper and deeper as I unveiled one wonderful new poster after the next leaflet, and I realised instinctively that something wasn't quite right. And I said, Neil, don't you like the posters? He said, where does it say Labour's campaign for freedom and fairness? And I said, well, I mean, you know, people will get that idea and they'll understand that that's what it's about, but putting people first has really got it. He said, no, I'm sorry. I'm afraid I can't go along with this. You'll have to get them reprinted. So there's a problem with that, Neil. I said, we're launching the campaign in a week's time, and they've gone to the printers. He said, well, you have to send them back to the printers. And I said, okay, you'll have Labour's campaign for freedom and fairness. And we beetled round to the printers, and that afternoon I got them to put in little print, sort of printed and published by Labour's campaign for freedom and fairness up the sort of side. It was the first example really of, you know, the new Labour spin. But we still had our campaign, but we had Neil's campaign. Now, look, let's not get into all of the details of this. I mean, we had the red rose next and pulled down the red flag and put up the red rose. We launched that. And we got into the 1987 general election campaign. But I have to say, brilliant campaign as the 87 campaign was, and I feel very proud of Private Eye's subsequent description of me as the architect of Labour's brilliant election defeat. But it was a, you know, stupendous electoral defeat, albeit a brilliant campaign. But the simple point I want to make is this, and it contrasts with later, and I just make this important point. The point about the 87 campaign was that it was a respray job. You know, it was like taking this rather battered old Ford Fiesta and respraying it in brilliant new red rose colours. But as ever with even the best spray job, you know, the rust tends to sort of push through. And before you know where you are, you've got people realising that they've got the same old battered Ford Fiesta. And it's really why we needed not simply to respray the Labour Party, but to re-engineer the Labour Party and to create a different and better vehicle to enable us to win. And if anyone was in any doubt as to the necessity of that, the 1992 election and that just a calamitous defeat, it was it the third or the fourth election defeat in a row?
It was my second. I think it was probably the third, wasn't it?
Fourth. It was the fourth election defeat in a row.
Certainly
in 1992.
My second.
People just sort of wondered. I mean, sometimes I'm asked whether, with John Smith becoming leader of the Labour Party, by changing the face at the top, we could have brought about the Labour Party's success without going through all the changes that Tony Blair introduced, whether by having a new leader we could have left the Labour Party broadly intact and nonetheless gone on to win the 1997 election. And my answer to that is that I'm not saying that we would have lost in 1997 if John Smith had remained our leader, but we would have won that election had we done so with an entirely unreformed Labour Party, which in my view would not have been able to sustain our Labour government in office with the same success that we have enjoyed since 1997. And I think that my interpretation of Labour's experience in the 70s, in the 60s, is that whilst we were able to get elected as a government because of the highly unreformed nature of our party, we were less able to sustain a successful Labour government in office. And that's why I believe it was so important to reform the Labour Party, to re-engineer the Labour Party and create the new Labour Party that we did after Tony Blair became leader in 1994. Now, I know that some people will say that what got us elected in 1997 was all sort of brilliant spin and media management and, you know, all that sort of wizardry for which Alistair Campbell is famous. And I suppose if any of you had heard Alistair when he spoke the other month, you know, you might think that it was all sort of spin and media management, although I know actually that Alistair doesn't believe that. Because what got us our landslide victory in 1997 and what got us re-elected with another landslide majority in 2001, apart from obviously a little assistance from the Conservative Party, was the redefinition of Labour on the basis of recognisable values and a body of beliefs in which we remain anchored as a leftist centre political party. If I can just slip temporarily into marketing parlance, now there would have been no point if in changing the Labour Party and creating new Labour, we had entirely torn up the Labour Party brand. What locates us on the political spectrum, what differentiates us from the Conservative Party, that would have just caused not just enormous confusion amongst voters, but also a wholesale hemorrhaging from the Labour Party of many of those who had traditionally and habitually voted for the Labour Party, even when we lost. So our new Clause 4 was not about junking what we believed in and what we stood for, but expressing it in a modern way, in a contemporary parlance, in the context of a society which people recognised and felt part of, rather than trying to use language and mantras and ways of describing our politics, which everyone knew had been designed for the Labour Party's original constitution in 1918 and had long since ceased to seem relevant and meaningful to the way in which people spent their lives and wanted to do better for themselves and their families. And the making of New Labour was an intensification of a revisionist tradition in the Labour Party. At our best, we have always been a modernising Labour Party. My grandfather, Herbert Morrison, who was the manager architect of the 1945 general election victory, and we actually got a larger majority in 1997, but put that aside, he was the one who did it in 1945. He developed concepts of municipal socialism, of social ownership, what came to be called Morrisonian nationalisation, that were incredibly innovative and far-seeing for his era, for his age, but which then need to be succeeded by subsequent and further thinking, Crosland-ite thinking in the 50s and 60s, which rethought public ownership, rethought nationalisation in a very radical way. And the problem with Tony Crosland, I think, is that in so many ways his thinking had so many modern and relevant attributes, but what Crosland assumed was that we could just take for granted that the economy would just keep on growing, that we would have an ever sort of growing economic success, and that we didn't actually have to think so much about how we generated the wealth that he had ideas on the different use of. But it was also a project in the 1990s that sought to reunify the left and the centre ground of British politics, drawing together those threads, those traditions, both of social democracy and liberalism in our country, which at their height, at their most successful, had been so electorally triumphant in seeing off the Tories in the early part of the last century, but the division between which opened up a gulf within the centre-left opposition in our country, which gave such a huge electoral opportunity to the Conservatives, which they exploited with such power and such determination during the bulk of the last century. Now, let me just end by saying this. Or asking a question, which is, having created New Labour and got the election in 97 and got the election in 2004 and still ahead in the opinion polls in a sort of gravity-defying way, do we just maintain in aspic what we are and what we have, defend New Labour against all comers and against all critics, and just sail on as we are? And the answer to that, in my view, is that we can take pride in the considerable achievements of the Labour government since 1997. I mean, we have done an enormous amount, redistributing income and opportunity and life chances to the people who I represent in my constituency and, you know, many millions of our fellow citizens without breaking up the economy. We've brought about a huge reinvestment programme in our public services. We've brought about or are bringing about the greatest reorganisation of our constitution and government and devolution and decentralisation in this country that we've ever seen. And we've also brought about a change in this country's relationship with Europe and the European Union. And we've also started to rethink the nature of the state and how it sets about providing public services and tackling those vested interests that hold back the state in what it does. And we've started to do a great deal to tailor those public services to meet individual needs and what people expect us in the modern sort of consumer age, what people expect to see and receive and to the way in which they expect to relate to public services in the 21st century. But although we've changed a lot of politics in this country, and we have changed the electoral mould, certainly, we've certainly cracked that in this country, I don't think we've changed the whole mould of the way in which we conduct politics in this country, even though the electoral sort of furniture has shifted so dramatically. I think if we're going to succeed in really changing the mould of British politics, as opposed to the mould of electoral politics, we've got to bring our relationship in this country between Britain and Europe full circle and really put ourselves at the heart of the European Union rather than maintaining this half-in, half-out relationship that we persist with. I think that we've got to much more radically redefine and reshape the British state and how it operates in this country. And I think we've also got to address and tackle what remains and in many senses is growing in this country as a very worrying feature of our political system, and that is a lack of trust amongst people in politics in this country, and not just in this country. It's not just a British phenomenon. But the cynicism that abounds in politics, which is corroding, I think, and weakening and undermining the democratic fabric of our political system in this country in a very serious and dangerous way. So we have come a long way, we've done a great deal, but heaven knows we still have an enormous amount to do. Thank you very much indeed.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have just over 15 minutes left for questions. We have to be out of here by 2, so I invite hands up for questions for Peter from the floor. One here, and then 2. 1, 2.
Thanks. I was interested in your last point about the corrosion of the democratic fabric, and some people would say that there's a connection between the focus on direct connection with the electorate, so for example, the introduction of press conferences and the erosion of Parliament as a place of representation. And if you look at Robin Cook yesterday, you know, when he was asked why Mr. Blair wouldn't address the debate on possible war in the Gulf in Parliament, his response was, you know, he's got more important things to do than to sit here, which some people might think is an interesting reflection on democracy. If you go back over the past 2 or 3 years, the two biggest civil rights protests in history and also the biggest civil disobedience for 20, 30 years have all occurred. And do you see a connection between that move towards some kind of populist angst, if you like, and the undermining of people's sense of parliamentary representation?
Well, can I first of all say that that Robin Cook didn't say that the Prime Minister didn't have time to address Parliament. He said he didn't have time to sit in his place for 6 hours during a debate in Parliament, and I think that's not unreasonable. I've just come from the House of Commons, where the Prime Minister made a statement to the House about Iraq, and I should think he's still being questioned about it, even now. So I don't think anyone could accuse the Prime Minister of choosing not to hold himself accountable for his policies. He certainly does that. But I think that successive governments, including our own, have not treated Parliament as fully, as respectfully, as we needed and as other governments should have done too. I think there's another sense in which, because the Conservatives are such a staggeringly weak opposition, people feel that Parliament is not the same cockpit, the same adversarial chamber as once it was, because, you know, when you look at the other side, you know, well, I won't labour the point. And I think that I think the problem for this is twofold. First of all, you know, the public have been, in a sense, addicted to this sort of adversarial punching, repunching, slugging it out sort of politics. And when that sort of tends to sort of fade, they think politics has gone away, that it doesn't exist anymore. But that's not true. I think in a sense we can replace it with a more civilised, more intelligent, more adult sort of politics than that old sort of adversarial style represented. But I think the other thing that you have is the media coming in and saying, well, if this government's not faced with a proper opposition and if the Conservatives are so pathetic, we'll do their job for them. We'll slug it out. We'll throw everything we can at this government. we'll claw at Mr. Blair, take out his wife, destroy his closest friends and allies twice. I don't think people like that sort of politics either. We've got to sort of build up Parliament and build up Mr. Blair's accountability through press conferences, appearing before that 30-strong select committee, and doing all those other things to show that Parliament matters, and we don't have to rely on that sort of cynical politics that I think, frankly, so many in the media are injecting into the political bloodstream in this country. But I don't actually largely or mainly blame the media. I think that they're filling a vacuum, and I think they just need to be, that vacuum needs to be filled with something else.
Thank you very much for your interesting talk. I'm from Japan. Right now I'm temporary student at LSE, and because I'm from Japan, I'm working for political party in Japan. But we are the center left, but we are not in power yet. So I'm coming here to learn from you a lot. So I'm quite serious, and also I'm very, I have to appreciate your practical answer to my question. So I know that you used to be in charge of 1997 campaign. So I wanted to know two things. What did you care about most in development of machinery in Labour campaign? And also second question is, when you enter into government, in the beginning, you were minister with that portfolio in charge of Prime Minister's office and also cabinet office, especially in the field of political communication. But then, what did you find in terms of communication in Downstreet number 10? Né? What are the problem with it? Né? How did you want to change that press office and the communication department at number 10?
Thank you.
I don't want to sort of skirt around your question, but if you go to my website, which is a veritable goldmine of speeches, articles, and other fascinating contributions to public debate in this country, you will find, I think, somewhere, but if you don't, let me know, a speech which I delivered sometime in 1998 when I was Minister Without Portfolio about reforming and professionalising communications in government. Suffice to say that what we found when we got there was a legacy of demoralisation, a grave lack of professionalism, a sense in which communications were sort of bolted on as a sort of an afterthought to policy making and government decisions, rather than built in as part of the process from the beginning, on the basis that unless you're communicating what you do and what you're thinking, and unless you can get that across in a way that is meaningful to people, then you will not have done the job that you want to achieve in government, which is not only to construct the right policies, but to persuade people to support them and to sustain them, even when the times get hard in their implementation. And that's what governed our approach. But www.petermanelson.com, and you'll, it's sort of there.
Hi. You mentioned the antics of the media, and then you said, don't blame the media.
Entirely.
Okay. What direction did you want Labour's media policy on newspaper ownership to take when you were working under Smith and Kinnock? Did you feel that the policy on newspaper ownership was relevant to what you were trying to do, and did you have a view on how it should develop?
Well, it wasn't a huge issue, although when we subsequently, in our planning for the 1997 general election, went back and researched the Tory-supporting tabloid press treatment of Neil Kinnock in the 1992 election. I mean, our reaction, if you remember, Philip, was first of all one of horror that anyone at any party could have been subjected to such treatment in a democracy and live to tell the tale. And a feeling that, you know, the people who run newspapers and edit them and write in them don't have a right, they do not have the right to create such a radical lack of balance and inequality in the treatment of parties and policies and personalities. It was so stark. I remember Tony Blair looking at this stuff one day and thinking, crikey, you know, reading all this, I don't think I would have voted Labour in 1992, and it was that bad. I don't think that we converted that then into a commitment to break up press ownership. I mean, I'm frankly a little hazy. But I remember arguing myself, I wrote in an article in a newspaper in 1993, that whereas it would be sort of pleasing and rather gratifying to be able to sort of storm Wapping and, you know, break up the Murdoch empire so that it could, together with, you know, the Daily Mail and the rest, never do to us again what they'd done in 1992, I remember arguing that the better approach would be to create greater media competition, you know, enabling people to sort of build up their commercial position in order to rival and challenge Murdoch, rather than use legislation to break up his commercial organisation. And I think probably I still do hold to that view on a good day.
Gentleman in the blue shirt.
I was wondering what's your view of the recent publication of a dossier by the government, which relied heavily on a paper written by an American student, and more specifically, would you agree that this might be a manifestation of maybe an unholy marriage between New Labour politics and New Labour media machine, so to speak?
No, I don't think you can generalise from the particular, and I don't think you can, cast, you know, the entire workings of Mr. Campbell's empire just by what was not a large document, but a relatively small section of a document, which I have to say I didn't read or see. It seemed to disappear so quickly from the from circulation that I couldn't get my hands on it before it went. But to be honest, I don't know much about it, but I wouldn't read too much into it, and I wouldn't infer too much from it. I mean, if you think of the output, the sheer volume of what pours out of the number 10 and Downing Street communications machine, it is overwhelmingly factual, truthful, and has genuine integrity. If it didn't have those things, then they wouldn't last 10 minutes in the face of media scrutiny.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mendelssohn. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. Quick question in regards to the New Labour as a party. What do you think will occur when the Conservative Party finally manages to get a strong leader, for example, like Chris Patten, to start competing in general elections? And secondly, would you be willing, or have you been offered, to become the new Commissioner of Britain to the European Union?
In answer to your first question, about Chris Patten and the Conservative leadership, he's not a Member of Parliament, so he can't stand, so he's got a difficulty there, and he doesn't stop being a Commissioner until 2004, and I don't really believe that, you know, there's much possibility of Mr. Duncan Smith lasting until 2004. I have a very clear view. I mean, if the Conservatives want to get their act together, if they want to deliver a half-decent opposition and chase the government around, they have to elect Kenneth Clark as their leader, and I have absolutely no doubt at all about that. I'm not sure I want them to. On the other hand, seriously, I think that any government, including this government, suffers from not having an effective opposition. I mean, any organisation, any business that doesn't have, you know, that spur of competition is not kept on its toes as much as it needs to be. And I think actually the government will probably benefit from having a tougher, more effective opposition, now I think about it. So let's have Ken Clark. Vote Ken.
There's time for one more question. The gentleman in the red sweater in the corner.
Just to your point that you made concerning New Labour being very firmly rooted in the people's interest and what their real concerns are, do you have the impression that this has massively changed after the 15th of this month, when there was the protest of 2 million, some people say 1.5, but definitely the biggest demonstration ever in British history, that this has massively changed? And what is your understanding of morality, or in how far does morality and democracy play in that? In how far do you feel happy to still communicate that this would be the right way to go if the majority of the people is against it?
I mean, I'm glad people marched. I'm glad people marched. You know, I'm glad people care enough about politics. I'm glad they care enough about international affairs and what happens abroad, which people didn't always care about. And I'm glad that these international issues are at the centre of our political debate in this country. The reason I don't agree with them is because I believe, I'm afraid, that you have to back diplomacy, you have to back persuasion with the threatened use of force. When confronted by somebody like Saddam Hussein with weapons, chemical, biological weapons of mass destruction that he has, nobody disputes that he has, a man who is impervious to international pressure, against whom no concept of deterrence would operate, and who is in defiance of successive resolutions of the United Nations, and if any of us believe in the sort of international system of international consensus, of the exercise of will by the international community embodied in what the United Nations stands for, then I think we have to stand up for the United Nations and back its resolutions and enforce its will and make sure those who are in defiance of the United Nations comply with the international community. And if we don't see this one through and achieve that, then we will never have the authority, we will never have the decisiveness, we will never have the position, I don't believe, to face any similar or such threat again. And I think that will make the world a colossally more dangerous place to live in.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank Peter Mandelson and Philip Gould, but especially Peter Mandelson, for a very stimulating, frank, and disarming hour. And we more than welcome you back at any time, Peter. Thank you very much indeed.